As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.
From an Indian perspective, if I were to ask an Indian analyst, they would be looking up and saying, oh, I'm being surrounded by PRC, their Maritimes Road, their Silk Road, the Belt Road Initiative. I feel like I'm putting in a box and I need to punch out of this.
Aloha and welcome to Dialogue, where conversations shape security. I'm your host, James Minnick, Colonel United States Army retired and professor here at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. This is episode 41, India's Strategic Challenges. India is navigating one of the most complex security landscapes in its modern history. As the world's largest democracy and a rising power, it faces a volatile security environment shaped by border conflicts, maritime competition, and shifting alliances. It is engaged in an uneasy standoff with China along the line of actual control, where territorial disputes continue to spark military clashes. Meanwhile, Beijing is expanding its reach in South Asia and the Indian Ocean, testing India's strategic patience and military readiness. But India's challenges don't stop at its borders. In the Northeast, waves of migration from Myanmar and Bangladesh are fueling ethnic tensions, cross-border insurgencies, and illicit trade. Organized crime networks dealing in drugs, arms, and human trafficking are thriving in the lawless pockets of the region, creating security threats that stretch from the streets of Manipur to the diplomatic corridors of New Delhi. At sea, the Indian Ocean is becoming a contested space. China's so-called research vessels are mapping the ocean floor. Its fishing fleets are encroaching on sovereign waters. And its submarines are frequently appearing in the region. India is responding with underwater domain awareness initiatives, strengthening its naval capabilities and deepening maritime partnerships. But the questions remain, is it enough? India's defense modernization is accelerating. It is investing in next-generation fighter jets, hypersonic weapons, and advanced surveillance technologies. Agreements like the Logistics Exchange Memorandum of Agreement, or LEMOA, and the Defense Technology and Trade Initiative, DTTI, are strengthening its military ties with the United States, while its role in Quad is evolving as it balances alliances with the West and its long-standing strategic autonomy. So what's next for India? Can it effectively deter China's ambitions? Will its partnerships with the U.S. and the Quad be enough to secure its future? And how does it navigate the complex web of regional security threats while maintaining its leadership in South Asia? To answer these questions, we are joined by Dr. Srini Sitaraman, an expert in Indo-Pacific security, South Asia, and India-China relations. He has spent years analyzing India's strategic trajectory and its role in global security. He's the author of The Global Battle for Industrial Dominance, China, America, and Europe in the 21st Century. Srini Sitaraman, welcome to Dialogue. Glad to have you back.
Dr. Minnick, it's wonderful to be back. Wonderful to be talking South Asia again with you. Thanks for the invite.
We benefit from having you back here and your experience and your expertise. And so while you've been here a couple times before, without a doubt, we'll have new members tuning in today. And so maybe you might just share a little bit of your story and how you came to this field.
I was actually reflecting on this point, not just here, but we had a session with our new director, and she was asking all the faculty about their stories and background.
Yeah.
So, and after I mentioned a few things, I was thinking about how could I have said it better? So this might be an attempt for me to say it better. So I come from an academic background. If I have done anything for the longest period of time continuously, I've been in the academic world, and I've been studying the region. So prior to arriving here, I was a professor at a university in the northeast
I
part of
know
the
well, I
U.S.
was on the hiring committee that brought you here. I
Yes.
remember you interviewing.
Yeah. So I was there, and prior to that, I was in different places in the United States while I was completing my studies. And I'm originally from India. I'm from the southern part of India, which is the state of Tamil Nadu. When I grew up as a kid, it was known as Madras, Madras, and now it's known as Chennai. And I lived in different parts of India, if I were to call that as a origin home, that would be that. I've been here at the center for about a little over 5 years, 5.5 years, and I work on South Asia, industrial policy, economics and security, and maritime, particularly with the reference to Indian Ocean region.
Yeah, the industrial policy piece that I mentioned during the introduction, that of course wonderful chapter in our book on the Indo-Pacific player.
Yeah, it was a fantastic opportunity to reflect and think back on evolution of industrial policy, how we have come, especially I watched India's industrial policy when they went in a different direction totally, not very long ago. And now they are trying to shift their focus in a new way. So they're sitting at the cusp, as you mentioned.
Yeah, no, and we're working on another book, America's Strategic Edge, and I know you're contributing
I
to that
am
as well.
looking
We're looking forward
forward
to that.
to it. I'm
Yeah.
looking forward to it. I saw the beautiful poster
Yeah,
in there.
no,
Yeah.
it's coming along.
Yeah.
Well, that's fascinating. Every time we talk, I get a little more deeper glimpse
In the
into the things
region.
you've done and what you've done, and without a doubt, going to get more into the region. You
Yeah.
just came from the region. You
Yes.
We're in India, all over India, back in January. Just
Yes,
say,
I
yeah.
spent a little over 2 weeks visiting. I was in Punjab, I was in New Delhi, I was in Calcutta, I was in two cities in the south, in Bangalore and Chennai too. I made a huge trip, and it was a learning experience in many ways, because while I was in Punjab, the first time I had actually the chance to go to the Attari Wagah border, which is the border, this is a land border that separates India and Pakistan. There's beating of the retreat ceremony, and I saw the ceremony prior to the Republic Day celebrations, which is a big deal in the region. So the security was tight, but it was a spectacular occasion to watch the dynamics. And what really struck me in that particular thing is that, the militaries, as you are familiar with it, and you took us to the DMZ a couple of years back. The militaries, much like in DMZ, are just facing each other
Yes.
across an iron grate that slides across like this. And there are people still crossing, with suitcases and bags and stuff. And they actually have a trolley like we have in our airports. They have a trolley. And they're actually, people, there are people to people exchanges going on,
Yes.
people crossing the border. And that's the only land border they can actually cross, because other places, if you want to fly air to Pakistan, for instance, from India, you have to go to Dubai or some other second place and fly from there. There's no direct connection. There used to be a train connection, which is no longer operational. There used to be a bus connection, which is no longer operational. So the land border, you physically have to walk across, do all the immigration paper on this side, go that side, do all your paper immigration, and then maybe catch a taxi or whatever and go to whichever destinations you need to go. So the people to people can, although very small, but it was still fascinating to see it in real time. While a major ceremony is going on here in the corner, there are people crossing the gates.
Very familiar with that type of operation. When I was the Secretary of the Military Armistice Commission in Korea, we supervised the different transit points. Of course, you'd mentioned up at Panmunjom by the DMZ where we went, but also over in the corridors where people transited. And I've got
Yeah.
plenty of stories, but fascinating. You were, keeping track of you was like, where's Waldo? Because you had pictures of you all over the place. I read
Right.
your report. It was quite interesting. And looking forward to the opportunity to sit down
I'm looking for a
today.
chat about it,
And
sure.
so let's start the conversation then. And maybe we'll start, well, let's talk about the border. Let's talk about China at
Yes.
India's borders. And so China is mounting pressure on India
Yeah.
through border incursions, trade leverage, influence in South Asia. There seems to be quite a few points of pressure which is being placed on India. So here's the question. What strategies can India use to counterbalance China's regional influence?
Fantastic question. That's a hard
It
question,
is a hard. It's
not an easy answer. So let me go back a little bit in time. So when the British colonial period ended, the region of
Was it 1947?
1947 was the official date of independence for South Asia broadly. But the movement, from 1942, 1943, 44 onwards, there were winds of change. And I think World War II accelerated the winds of change. What happened was Tibet was basically an unexplored area. You really have to start with Tibet. And as early as the late 1800s, early 1900s, the Brits were sending expeditions into Tibet.
That's right.
And there was a British India outpost in Tibet. I'm not saying Britain had designs or anything like that, but they were interested. That was a large territory, was vastly ungoverned and unexplored. There was no the Tibetan rulers was basically the monks, whose immediate reign only extended into Lhasa and some of the adjoining areas, but much of it were open land, a grazing land, and a lot of uninhabited territory. So the Brits were interested. So when the Brits left, there was no really demarcation where Tibet ended and where India began. And that's what the British were trying to establish. And there was some general understanding, and this was the McMahon line, which sort of a line in the map, which divided Tibet. But Tibet was Tibet in 1947. From starting 1949, when the Communist Party of China takes over, from 49 to 59, the People's Republic of China exerts complete control over Tibet to the extent that the Dalai Lama is expelled. He runs across a land route and he comes in India, and he's still alive, very elderly, but the Tibetan exile regime basically operates out of Dharamshala in India. So he has been there since 58. And by 59, the PRC is in complete control of that area. So the origins of the India-China border dispute begin with that period, late 50s, 60s. India has a perception that their border is on the McMahon line, and China believes that's not where the border of Tibet is. But India, there's a group within India that says China, Tibet is not really Chinese, and Chinese are arguing, no, Tibet is mine. So it's about where the territorial perceptions are. And the area, as you know, is highly mountainous, extremely cold, which you have experienced, and not easily accessible at all, extremely rugged terrain. You're talking about low oxygen and all that stuff. But India and China actually forced the first war in 1962,
That's right.
right? And it was a very costly one because India was essentially underprepared for a major assault, and it seemed to have lost a substantial territory at that time. And since then, basically, the roots of the India-China territorial conflict and the India-China tensions have prevailed. There have been several incursions because India and China basically share, which Tibet is now China, share about 4,000, a little over 4,100
Yeah,
kilometers,
so what is that?
right?
About
About 25,
2,600,
yeah,
2,500
26 miles,
miles. Yeah.
give or take. And that runs from the Tri-Corridor where Pakistan, Afghanistan, to all the way to Myanmar in the side. It's a big territory. So in 1963, what happens, a territory that's part of what India thinks is Kashmir, called the Sachkhand Valley, is transferred by treaty by Pakistan to PRC. India still claims that part as its own. So this incursion, this sort of border tensions has prevailed since then. There have been several flashpoints, and there have been several treaties with China in trying to tamp down the tensions. But what was really surprising about the most recent one that we all refer to is the June 2020 incident in the Galwan Valley, which is on the other end of Aksai Chin, right in there on the what we call the eastern side of that. It's a narrow corridor, but there's several flashpoints along that corridor.
Yeah, and this was fairly brutal. I mean, you had because arms are prohibited there. I mean, this is,
Firing is
yeah,
prohibited
that's right. And
by
so they've got,
treaty.
clubs and
Yeah, and they
it's pretty
used,
brutal, right?
yeah, it was 20 Indian soldiers, including a colonel in the Indian Army, perished. And I hear some of them may have perished because of hypothermia, or they've fallen down a ravine and they couldn't be saved in time, extracted. And even the PLA suffered losses, four by official counts and maybe one later. And that has been a sticking point in the in India-China relations.
So they are in a better point now than they were
Yeah,
then, right?
so until 2019, in 2019, October of 2019, India and China, with President Xi and Prime Minister Modi, had a major summit in India,
That's right.
where Modi gave Xi red carpet, quite literally red carpet everywhere, cleaned up the entire city, all that, and they were going for a grand bargain.
Right.
In June of 2020, you had this skirmishes,
That's right.
and then it was COVID, and then at the last five and a half years, the relationship has really soared.
It has.
The most recent where I see there's a thaw in that relationship is they met at the sidelines of the BRICS summit in Kazan in
That's right.
Russia,
That's right.
where they actually sat across from each other on the table and they agreed. And today, just today, the Indian Prime Minister in a podcast made a statement referring to we have to raise about the consequences of these events and we have to find a middle ground and we have to deconflict and everything. And China has welcomed that statement. Now, the underlying territorial issue has not been resolved,
No.
not at all. So the claims that China has over that part of the region, it continues to have. Claims that India has over that part of the region, it continues to have. China still continues to what do you call, board up that area, fortify, bunker, tunnel, put placements of all the weapons that they could. And India is doing what it can in their own. So the underlying causes of the dispute have not been resolved, but there's a thaw in the relationship. Currently, March 17th, 2025, there's a thaw in relationship. That's all we can say. So remains. China as a strategic territorial threat remains.
Okay.
And there's another dimension. As you know, China's relationship in the region has increased tremendously. It
Oh,
was
by
not
far.
this 20 years back. You have the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. The defense procurement relation between China and Pakistan is robust. The defense procurement relation with China and Bangladesh is equally good. China's footprint in Nepal is very, very powerful. So is it in Maldives. So is it in Sri Lanka. From an Indian perspective, if I were to ask an Indian analyst, they would be looking up and saying, oh, I'm being surrounded by PRC, their maritimes road, their Silk Road, the Belt Road Initiative. I feel like I'm putting in a box and I need to punch out of this. That's where the situation is, in short.
Yeah, and I imagine you must have heard some of that while you were
Yes,
visiting
yes.
in
So
China.
they are in the region, they are worried about not just a conflict with PRC alone, but they're worried about opening up new fronts along the line, which China could do anytime. They're worried about Myanmar, which is a very which is experiencing civil war, in which the military's foothold seems to be decreasing, and some of that conflict, not all of it, but some of it seems to be slipping over into a border on the Indian side, which again is very fluid.
I mean, let's pull on that some more.
Yeah,
Let's just
yeah.
do that. I mean, so without a doubt, Northeast is in a bit of a crisis. And you're writing some other papers. And I was reading one of those
Yeah.
today. I mean, there's ethnic tensions, there's
Right.
cross-border migrations, organized crime that is destabilizing India's Northeast, where you got Myanmar and Bangladesh. There's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
So how can India balance security and humanitarian concerns in that volatile region? What do you recommend?
Oh boy, they have a challenge in their hands, right? The challenges in Myanmar, I was looking at an old map, and this map was published in 1920, I believe. And parts of Myanmar is ripe even during that time for poppy cultivation, a thing that
Yes, of course.
you have seen it
In
firsthand
Afghanistan,
in Afghanistan,
plenty of,
plenty
yes.
of them. So after the Taliban's return in 2021, the poppy cultivation per capita has declined in Afghanistan while it has gone up on this
Okay,
corridor, right, in Myanmar. And that is proving to be a very lucrative business, especially the trijunction on the other side with Myanmar and Thailand is emerging into a very sort of a wild, wild west, if you might gambling, drugs, scams, all the things that go along with it, alcohol, and all that in the border towns in those area. And that is proving to be the life sources for many of the militias that are waging this war against the military regime in Myanmar, which threw Aung San Suu Kyi back into the prison, and they are in power now. And the military regime is supported by PRC, obviously. They're providing them weapons and all kinds of intelligence and resources because the PRC believes that they are the they can maintain law and order, but on the ground reality is that they've been losing large chunks of territory. And India too has been supporting the military regime because they believed that they will be continue to assert dominance in the region. It's better to be in good books with them rather than alienate them. But now I see a very subtle shift. The shift is there was a recognition that the control of the ruling regime in Myanmar is ever so ever slowly dwindling because they don't have the troops and they don't have the control in the deep mountainous area of the region. And many of the troops, many of the militia or militants or however we describe them, they're operating from the Indian side. The weapons and the drugs and the people are also moving along with them. So, and it is generating regional, extra regional tensions in terms of housing, land resources, access to education, access to government jobs, those sorts of things there.
I want to pull on these comments about yours about the organized crime threat. But before we do that, I mean, as a result of those things, I just want you to maybe take a minute and talk a little bit more about, the flow of people across the
Right.
borders and how that is affecting those border towns, as it were.
Perfect. So, as early as last week or earlier of Thursday, I believe, the chief minister, who is like a provincial governor, governor would be what we would say, but in the India system, they have a governor and a chief minister. Chief minister is the chief executive of the state of Mizoram, said, there's no really big differences between us and the people on the other side of the Mizoram border. They're also Mizos, right? Typically, that border area, what they had something called the free movement regime.
They
That's
did.
what
I
is
mean,
it?
that came from the 60s, I think. So it
Yeah.
was a very long
Yeah,
established free
established.
movement
It
regime.
was as much as 80 kilometers,
Right.
and over a period of time, it has shrunk and shrunk and
I
shrunk.
think it's
So
down to 10 kilometers now.
it's
That's
now it's down
very
to
small.
small.
And those are people who live right in that area.
Right in the area, and there are border crossings, and so if you have one of those passes, you can go across. But the states in Mizoram, Manipur, even Nagaland, they are saying this is foolish because I have my cousins. We see each other. We drink tea. We meet at the corner house, and you can't stop us from moving. India said, no, we're going to fence that region, smart fencing, because many of the stump region is highly mountainous, and we're going to prevent the movement of people. That is not being accepted by the people on the area at all. So I don't know if that could succeed, whether the rhetoric of what they're suggesting could actually translate into reality in the region. They believe the problem for their the solution for the problems is lie on the other side of the border, which I think is not entirely accurate because some of the problems are in many ways a self-inflicted gunshot, or more.
Yeah.
Because they have done some internal policies which seemingly seems to privilege one group over the other in terms of land access, resource access, and education and government jobs. That's really the C. So in India, there are different categorization, right? You could be a scheduled caste or a scheduled tribe, SCST. Those, they get reservation up to 18% in all kinds of things. So even if you score very low in some of the marks in your exams in different categories for government jobs or your exams to engineering colleges, medical colleges, you're given special privileges and you're put in. So there's one ethnic group which pretty much enjoyed those. These are the Kukizos in Manipur who enjoy these privileges. They suddenly came in and said, now Métis, who are the valley people, they're going to enjoy those special privileges too. And the people in the mountainous area, why are these people getting it? They're already well off. They're already well settled. They can't get it. Only I'm a tribe. They're not a tribe. How can you define somebody as a tribe? So that's where it really, it's one of the trigger points for the extraordinary amount of violence that happened in the region. Women were assaulted en masse. People were burned. Houses were burned. Lot of loss of life. And still, there are frequent road closings, internet shutdown, cell phone services disconnected to prevent spread of misinformation. That is the official source. And the state government in BJP state government was it collapsed. The chief minister resigned, and they could not find an alternate for him. Now it is the state of Manipur is directly ruled by the central government in New Delhi. So it's called the president's rule. That's what they have now in that region. So it's that tense.
When I had Dr. Mimi Nguyen Bird here recently, and we spoke about Myanmar, and we spoke about the organized crime networks, and we were just talking about that. And these are massive. I mean, give a bit of a scope, particularly, whether we're talking about the scam centers or whatever, but we're talking billions of dollars of transactions of money. And when you and it's not just restricted there. I mean, Cambodia, et cetera, through other places,
Wow.
and Laos and Southeast Asia and other places, it's really exp and the and then the support that the that's the apparatus that supports this, I mean, 100,000 people, they got to eat, and so food's being catered
Right.
in there, or they need all these different services and stuff. And so the external market to the corrupted market is also very large, and it's just the scope is
Enormous,
enormous. And
enormous,
so when we took
lucrative.
it,
It's very lucrative.
it is. And so I want people to I want to foot stomp that a bit, because we're just not talking about minor organized crime networks. We're talking about massive flows of capital and people who are engaged in these things.
Right, and this is unverified, but probably could be verified. I've heard like investors coming down from the Yunnan province because it's right there. And they're coming in with bags of cash or crypto or investment opportunities. They're putting money in casinos, trafficking, fentanyl production, poppy cultivation, heroin, everything. There's so much money to be made in this border towns. This is informally told by academics and others that many people in the respective law and order organizations in the states in India are well aware of it. Law and order and the politicians are well aware of some of the stuff. This guy was telling me that I knew it when I was a child. Now only the scale has become industrial. And he's of the view that there are many people who are taking bribes. They are saying one thing in the media and acting one way. But taking money and taking the money and buying land outside of the state, somewhere else, or investing the money in buying property outside of the country, or doing such things, and they're not being very honest with how what they're telling and what they're doing. I mean, it's a human condition. I get it, but that's another point to be highlighted.
We talked about the challenges they're having with the relationship with China and its pressure on different points. We went on and we spoke about some internal issues. We spoke about the Northeast. We certainly could have spoke about over on the West. There's plenty going on there. We've spoke about the challenges that come from organized crime. This is not exhaustive by any stretch. If we could probably circle around so many more challenges, and maybe we'll even come back to that a bit. But let me pull this conversation into a little bit of different direction. And I want to ask you about India's maritime watch. And so, I mean, it's expanding its underwater domain awareness, which it needs to, right? I mean, to secure its maritime boundaries, counter China's presence in the Indian Ocean. And I alluded to some of that earlier. And so let me ask you this question. How will India's underwater domain awareness initiatives, how will it strengthen its maritime security and regional stability, these initiatives? How will they do that?
So, this is again my view, and people can obviously challenge this view or counteract this view. There's a lot of this talk about India being the net security provider in the region. And I think it's actually happening in the maritime domain. So, by their own admission, they become by default a net security provider in the region of maritime. I'm particularly talking about piracy, hijacking, patrolling, HADR, rescue missions, supply and protection, supply of personnel to protect oil tankers or something in critical zones, rescue operations. All of that, India's been doing it quite quietly, more or less quietly. Nobody hears about it. Because by the Indian Navy's own admission, you look from the Gulf, the Straits of Hormuz to Straits of Malacca, and to some extent, the Mozambique Channel and the south of Colombo, and even the little gap between India and Sri Lanka is where they see Indian Navy legitimately operating. They see that as their AOR. They really don't see themselves operating outside of Hormuz or outside of the Straits of Malacca. They feel like geographically they got enough maritime real estate to cover. And what they're really interested with the UDA is they don't know what is happening, a lot of what is happening. And they feel there are foreign research vessels that are coming there
They
a
are
lot,
coming in there, aren't they?
and their fishing fleets coming there. And they're really worried about cutting of the underground cables from
Oh, I
the
had an
Gulf.
episode in not so long ago with Divya Rai, and she actually wrote a chapter on India's submarine cables. It was fascinatingly illuminating and the scope of the challenges of the just how much is underwater cables they have and stuff. And these are increasingly not just there, but everywhere. Yeah, they're at risk. They're being cut. They're being and that's she brought this up that there's a lot that needs to be done to protect the underwater
They're really worried
vessels. But
about
say
it.
more. Yeah, say
They're
more.
really worried about it. And that's why they are increasingly looking to the United States and other nations in the West for technologies and domain awareness mapping, seeing what is there. Because they're also worried, they're also interested and as well as worried about competition in the area, about oil exploration, mineral exploration, particularly deep sea mining, and protection of the fishing stocks and oil pollution. I've heard this from smaller South Asian littoral states. They're worried about oil pollution because a lot of this trafficking ships, they dump a lot of garbage, and they dump a lot of oil, either accidentally or deliberately. A lot of refuse is dumped in the ocean. They're really worried about the quality and the impact upon their fishing resources in the region. So they want some kind of mechanisms to prevent pollution, oceanic pollution, and also cleanup mechanisms to prevent that from happening. It's like kind of regime in there. And they've been having a lot of meetings. In our own maritime security track this past CSC, there were robust discussions on maritime fusion centers and maritime awareness, broadly awareness. And folks, just not India, but also countries like Maldives and Mauritius, they've become very interested in expanding their knowledge base on these particular issues. So, but India's been stepping in on that one, especially on the Western Ocean, that could become of serious because of the Houthis operating outside of the platform. Previously, we have the Somali issues and all the majority of the shipping traffic, whether it goes around South Africa or it comes through the Gulf, it has to go through the Indian Ocean across the Straits of Malacca into the eastern part of the country, eastern part of the world. So that's, and if you look at the Sea Vision mapping, that area is thick with the flow of shipping traffic.
I don't know when you were in a country whether you had discussions about some of the technologies and stuff, but the with the UDA and but I mean India really is doing quite a bit in the nuclear powered submarine in expansions there in those areas there with anti-submarine warfare with a lot of number of those different expanded areas to be able to increase its capability and its capacity in the UDA area. Is that right?
So that is the tension, right? If you look at it, if you're a country outside of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, outside of some of the major proliferation architecture, and they operate nuclear power submarines or nuclear attack submarines, and they are obviously concerned about some of the major strategic competition. So if you are in a country with the technology and availability, you also worry about intentions, right? Is your intentions benign? Are you going to use it for military? There is that tension. And one of the discussions we regularly ran into this challenge is that they were, no, we are only interested in benign trade, oceanic pollution, those sorts of things. We're not interested in for nuclear submarine trafficking and all those things. But in the world, these technologies could have dual use applications. But it seems to me they're actively seeking such technologies for sonar arrays, buoys that can be floated in the submarines that can give you signals.
AI will definitely play a
AI,
big role in trying.
they're thinking about this is a little bit futuristic about potential a drone fleet that would an underwater drone fleet or even a surface drone fleet that will fly over and map. It will give you a domain awareness of what is happening in the region. So if you're a commander sitting on a commander battleship or you're sitting in a booth somewhere, you want to have a picture of what is happening in the domain and what are the challenges happening at any given moment. And what do I respond? What do I not respond? A distress call, a pollution incident, a hijacking, or a potential, what do you call, a malign actor in the region trying to do some national security risk for you. And of course, all of this has to be put in the context of pre-existing conflict between India and Pakistan and the growing military tensions between, growing, I should say, political tensions between India and Bangladesh. And people, obviously, Pakistan is a nuclear power. It has nuclear weapons. It has a navy. It has an air force. And it is very capable, militarily capable state. And it has proven that over and over again. And of course, you have PRC. And even Bangladesh has a submarine fleet. Even Myanmar has a submarine fleet. So that area is getting
It's
crowded.
getting very crowded.
It's getting crowded.
Let's pull on another topic. Let's talk about U.S.-India defense ties. And I alluded a little bit of this in my opening, but I mean there are a number of bilateral agreements like the U.S.-India Defense Technology and Trade Initiative or the LMOA. I mean these are deepening military and technology cooperations between those two countries, right? So, what are the key opportunities and challenges in expanding U.S.-India defense collaboration? Would you offer?
As you know, it's a very interesting question and a very timely one because just today and tomorrow will be the major speech. The Director of National Intelligence, she is visiting India, New Delhi. Just yesterday, she met with the chief of India's intelligence agency, the defense minister, and the prime minister himself. She's also going to give the big address in the Raisina dialogue tomorrow. And that's one of the big stops that she's making on her way to other visits across the Indo-Pacific. That's a really a big signal, both from the United States as well as from India, and the level of a protocol accorded to the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, and how she was welcomed and the senior level meetings that are happening. So that being said, what has been what they discussed was not publicly revealed, excepting bilateral relations and mutual security concerns is what we really know. But we know that India is already on they've purchased the Predator drone systems from the United States. They are already operating the P-8s.
Yeah, they are.
They're operating the C-130 platforms.
They're cooperatively working on engines, aircraft
The
engines
aircraft engines,
for yeah.
the GE
Yeah.
engine.
Yep.
I heard a lot about that. So another area, they just signed an accord for Starlink satellite communication. That's just day before yesterday. I don't know the details. And India and the US collaboration through the Quad on cybersecurity, on quantum, on biotechnology, the satellite telecommunication, chip making is all on the strategic industrial defense industry policy chain is moving. Maybe not as fast as it probably should, because obviously there are gaps in technology and infrastructure and other challenges,
And there's
but
transfer issues, of course,
and
from
transfer issues and all that. But one of the things that I had an opportunity to chat with, and no big answer came out of it, was India's probably in the market for an air platform, fighter jet platform. Right? They have their light combat aircraft, but as you know, PRC just came out with their sixth gen fighter. So there's definitely a palpable concern in the security circles about the sixth gen fighter and whether they can match the air superiority. So they're looking at different platforms
They are. I mean,
from.
I think they're looking at, like I said, these advanced generations, but they're also looking at like F-21s and F-18s and things to be able to launch off of aircraft
Aircraft
carriers and
carrier.
stuff, right?
Yeah, they're looking at that. And they're also looking at, fourth, fifth gen fighter jets off the shelf. But I'm hearing it is also, India is a new thing where they want to do co-production, they want to do co-manufacturing
That's exactly
and
right.
some
That's
technology
right.
transfer and some patent sharing. And I think that's where a lot of the nuances are there for these treaties to move forward. Even, interestingly, in the big meeting at White House, when the Prime Minister visited and met the president said, why don't you look at F-35s? So I don't know if that's in the offing, but I've heard of F-21, F-18, those are two platforms I've heard. And India is also looking at French systems. They seem to particularly love that because they seem to understand that better. In there. And there, as you know, we were talking about a lot of communication. How does an F-35 communicate or an F-21 communicate with a Rafale? How does it even communicate with a Sukhoi or a Mirage? How does air-to-air communications work? How does when the squadrons fly together? What kind of systems are they using? A lot of detailed technical nuances exist. What are the adjustments need to do? What kind of CNC they need to put in? What are the conditions for which they can work seamlessly together? And I think they're having those discussions, obviously behind closed doors, but those kind of very minute technical details are being fleshed out.
Well, as you describe India's air power leap, I mean, maybe the simple question is, I mean, will this defense modernization, will it actually enhance its deterrence against the regional threats? It's one thing about having capabilities, it's another thing about those capabilities being able to achieve what you need. And it takes a lot of effort, right? It's not about having things. It's operational employment.
Correct.
It's having sustainability of the platforms. It's about being able to have a long maintenance capability. It's about
Correct.
having enough munitions and stuff that go on those platforms. I mean, it is complicated stuff, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And
And
so,
I mean,
I mean, say
yeah, I
that.
mean, this is you've experienced it yourself, as you know, as a commander, you've experienced it yourself. And this is beautiful. I mean, from a analytical point, I'm saying it's beautiful,
Yeah.
the war fighting aspect of it. Because if you are going on a strategic buildup and posturing in the name of deterring major rivals in the region, the rivals are looking at this and going, I'm going to one up you. And this, as you very well know, could lead to, arms racing,
Yes, of
which
course.
is sort of happening. But there's also capacities, how much of your GDP are you willing to divert towards arms raising, and how much are you willing to divert to other sort of expenses? And that is a problem that they're all encountering. Because, if you look at the Indian defense budget, probably half of it, or a little more than half of it, just goes towards maintenance. All right.
Of course.
Paying the salaries, all the benefits and pensions and the veterans care and all that go along with it. And maintaining a large standing army is expensive, and sustaining it in remote locations
Tremendous.
and rotating them through and all that. And even Pakistan is looking at it and going, you're buying all these things, I'm going to buy more stuff because I'm worried that you're going to do something to me. So there's that escalatory dynamic, which could potentially, be destabilizing in some ways, just for the region, talking about it, because you can do something. And there's a good point to mention the something, right? You see, just talking about India and Pakistan, the probability of a potential nuclear war remains more than zero, right? More than zero. But so far, it has not happened, but it is more than zero. If you have deterred each other from a potential conventional and nuclear war because you have nuclear weapons, the possibility of using irregular warfare becomes higher.
Seems
And
true.
that is what you're seeing since 2000s in the region. There's been, periodic escalations of these conventional, non-conventional incursions and terrorist attacks, bombs blowing up, and missile launches on each other. And when the tensions really heat up, as it did in 2019 between India and Pakistan, everybody was like, oh, our nuclear clock just, went on alert, because they're worried that if you are an asymmetrically weaker power on the conventional side, your temptation to use something like a small scale nuclear weapon would be very high. And it is doctrinally there
Yeah, that
in
is.
their military doctrine. They say if you're going to physically move your troops across the borderline and incur into my territory, I can potentially explode a nuclear weapon on my side, not on your side. A low yield nuclear weapon, 1 kiloton or less, right? Sufficient to cause significant damage. And what will you do at that point? Right? You're not, your conventional incursion is what? Are you going to respond nuclearly? And that's the point at which it becomes very
Yeah,
complicated.
absolutely.
Not the weapons themselves, but the possibility of this irregular warfare escalating things out of hand.
I'm gonna hold you there because, boy, I could talk about this topic, but I'm gonna have to constrain myself and you as well. In a real short response, I'm gonna ask you one last question before we go to audience questions, and that is, when we think about the Quad, India is
Yes.
hosting this year's summit, right? Quad
Yeah.
summit. And so, I mean, simple question. This won't be a simple question, but I'll ask for a simple, quick answer. How does India envision the Quad's role in the Indo-Pacific shifting security landscape?
Yeah, my understanding of this, and I've emphasized this, and again, their understanding of Quad as originally created, they see this as a grouping of like-minded states devoted to a cooperation and development and HADR and technology, right? They historically, they've been very careful about not presenting this as an anti-China grouping,
Yeah, no, you're
which is what Beijing wants and has
characterized it,
called
yeah.
it, characterized it. And they have gone to pains to separate that, the Malabar military naval
Yep.
exercises, which happens
Happens to be
independently.
the same four partners,
Same four
right?
major partners with the major naval platforms
Yep.
that exercise together. So there is that, and there's the Quad. I mean, of course, right after the new administration came in, the Secretary of State gathered the Quad members and met with them. So
That's
it
right.
tells me that the current administration, their priorities, at least at the very beginning, clearly seems they're interested in keeping those three countries as a part of this Quad network together.
Okay, that was fantastic. So let's go through a lightning round of a few of the audience questions, and so we'll go through as many as we can. So the first one is asking about India's biggest threat. Who is India's primary strategic adversary today, and why?
One word, one I would put I can't separate this. We can probably if I had a little bit more time, I can get into the nuances of it. I would say it's China and Pakistan, or you could say Pakistan and China. Some people say it's one of the
Depends
same.
on what you're looking at,
What
what
you're
you're
looking
counting,
at.
yeah.
That would be it. That would be it. Yeah.
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 No, okay, that's fair enough.
Yeah.
And you have
Just
actually,
the Indian perspective.
I know that, of course, that's what we're talking, the Indian
Yeah. Yeah.
perspective.
Just to
And
be clear for our audience.
no.
Yeah.
And I think that you kind of spoke about that through the interview. And so we'll
Right.
leave it at that. China, they have issues with China, they have issues with Pakistan or concerns.
Yeah.
So, next question. China's reach in South Asia, so how does India view China's presence and its involvement in Sri Lanka? We barely talked about Sri Lanka, but go ahead.
Okay. Oh, that's Sri
Quick
Lanka.
one though.
Yeah. So, as you know, India has a lot of history in Sri Lanka, and some of it is not altogether great, right? They have a very complicated history. As you said, originally, I'm from the state of Tamil Nadu, right there on the northern, southernmost part of India, and north of Sri Lanka, immediately the landmass of India is right there. And a lot of the refugees from the Sri Lankan conflict were in Tamil Nadu, in there. And there's a lot of fishing and cross-cultural stuff that happens, right? They're there, right? The PRC is there in every form of capacity
Including the
from
Hambantota, Tota,
Hambantota.
the port,
They are
yep.
in Gwadar, even though they're facing different kind of infrastructure and security challenges there because of the sustained terror attacks in there. They're there in some capacity in Maldives too. They are there in Bangladesh. They are there in Myanmar. They're everywhere. They were not there in the capacity. They're in Nepal, they're in Bhutan, they're everywhere. So if you're just looking at it from an Indian perspective, they realize that the People's Republic of China is a very significant, superior, asymmetric power in which the balance clearly tilts towards Beijing. They are in a perpetual struggle to constantly balance against them. Sri Lanka is where they attempted to balance against them very hard, and they probably did not entirely succeed in their effort, but they still tried. And I'll tell you the try part. So when Sri Lanka experienced a massive crisis in 2022, when their government collapsed because they couldn't pay their foreign debtors, over the period of the last 3 years, India stepped in and helped with some loans and guarantees and some bailouts, exchange transfers of currency, currency swaps, all sorts of things. Very quietly, it's done. And India has also invested a lot of money in different projects in Sri Lanka,
Yes.
in the region. So, is it sufficient to counter PRC's presence? Probably not. Probably not in scale and capacity as they have. But this is again my personal view. I think over the since the collapse of the Rajapaksa government, there's been a change in the perspective among the Sri Lankans, at least among some of the strategic elites in Sri Lanka. What they they have come to the realization, at least in my one-on-one conversations, whether they will publicly admit to it or not is a different story. They have come to the understanding that their whole scale shift post the end of the Civil War in 2009 to Beijing has not been all that good for their country. Now, seemingly it was great between 2009 to 2020, maybe 10, 12 years. I was in Sri Lanka in 2019 and I saw a lot of construction activity going on, malls, roads, bridges, towers, and all kinds of things. And it all seemed great, but they are stuck with the bill now. There's that, you know, and those investments have not generated the necessary what's called ROI, return on investments, for them to be able to say this is great. And I think that's, if at all there's one silver lining, I think it's a realization that they need to balance. And they have a new president who came to power in I believe in November, young the student-led revolution,
That's right.
young gentleman. And I don't know if he has still had the opportunity to interact with high officials in the United States, but he's interacted with New Delhi and, of course, in Beijing.
Yes.
And I'm hearing that they're going to play the balancing game. They're going to try and balance between India and
I
China.
think so.
There are things that they need to go to for China. There are things that they're going to go to India. And it has to be figured out where the United States figures into it. And I
Right.
think there's an opportunity for the United States in Sri Lanka
Yeah,
and Maldives.
frankly, much of the region is looking how to multi-line. We're really running short on time, so we'll see whether how many we can go through based on your brevity of your answers. This next one: strained regional ties. Why haven't India's relations with its neighboring countries been stronger than they are?
$1 billion question. Yeah, it's I don't let me take you an example as a area that we didn't get the chance to cover in detail, Bangladesh. So on August 5th, the Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina's Awami League Party just disappeared because of massive student protest. The
That's
causes
right.
are
She went
many.
into exile.
She's in India, very complicated history. Her father was the founder of the
That's right.
country. His father was assassinated along with her entire family. She comes back. She's in isolation in Germany, and then she comes back to India, and then she comes back in the 80s, and then she becomes a prime minister, loses, and then she's prime minister for four consecutive terms. Apparently, over the years, she's become very authoritarian and all that complaints. Now, what has happened is in a sea change for India, because it had very good relationship with Awami League. We don't, they haven't been able to establish any relationship. Even yesterday, the Director of National Intelligence and in her remarks on Bangladesh referred to challenges in the region. The US government is aware of it. So that is going to be a problem for India because they have an interim leader in Dr. Mohammad Yunus, but they don't know where the country is going to go. What is interesting is that Bangladesh has developed better very rapidly, very quickly established some good relationship with Pakistan, a
Yes.
country from which it separated in 1971.
Yeah, that's right.
And that has cost the strategic circles in New Delhi to chatter a
Quite
lot
bad.
more about the growing ties and what that means for the regional balance. Would India face consequences from two, three sides, four sides, maybe? What does it mean for US? What does it mean for India? So that remains to be seen.
Trina, this has been a fascinating hour together. We have run out of time, but before I let you go, I want you to share a book recommendation with the audience.
Okay. This is out of the blue. And I was thinking about it, and there are several options. I've just started reading. It's a tome. When I mention a tome, it's huge. I start and I'm able to go only a few pages a day. It's a book on a leader called Tipu Sultan. He was a small leader in the south west part of India, called the state of Karnataka. About 2 years back, I had an opportunity to visit that area and tour his formal kingdom. His old palace, his summer palace, his mosque, and all that. And there's a lot of controversy with Tipu Sultan. because some see us as a great freedom fighter, some see him as a religious leader who wanted to promote a particular version of a religion. And Vikram Sampath's book on Tipu Sultan is about 800 pages long. So if anybody wants to wade through it, or you can go online and listen to his lectures and read his sort of excerpts and published in different journals, that would be my recommendation.
So at 800 pages, slightly larger than the 700-page tome that I edited and that came out last month, right?
I don't know how you managed
I
that. I don't know. You never came out of your office, right?
was on the show with you and others many times. Rainey, we're grateful that you
Thank
spent
you.
time with us.
Thank
We'll
you.
look forward to having you back
Thank you.
again.
It was a pleasure.
As we conclude today's dialogue, India finds itself at a pivotal moment, navigating regional threats, accelerating military modernization, and forging strategic partnerships in a contested Indo-Pacific. The decisions it makes today will shape its security and influence the balance of power in the region and beyond. These conversations shape security. Join us on April 7th as I sit down with Dr. Bill Wininger, a professor here at DKI APCSS, to discuss China's nuclear rise, exploring its expanding arsenal, strategic ambitions, and the implications for global deterrence. On behalf of all of us at DKI APCSS, thank you for being part of this important conversation. I'm James Minnick, and until we meet again, aloha oi. As always, the opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.